From WAMU in Washington, I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's away at a conference. Islam is the world's fastest-growing religion. Scholar Karen Armstrong argues that it may also be the most misunderstood. In her new book, she traces its complex history. Her book is called Islam, A Short History. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you very much.
We'll invite our listeners to join our conversation later in this hour at our toll-free number, 1-800-433-8850. Karen Armstrong, how did you come to write this book?
Well, simply a friend of mine rang me up and asked me if I'd like to do it. But I rather jumped at the chance because I think Islam is much misunderstood. And I think that the it was a challenge for me to write such a complex and about such a complex issue in such a short space of time. 50,000 words is virtually nothing. But I thought it's a kind of unthreatening size, and people might just pick it up where they might shy away a little bit from something rather more huge and formidable, and just begin to understand. It's a taster, really, to get people into the Islamic way of thought and to see the immense richness of the tradition.
Yes, the book is about 200 pages long, not really a very daunting task to read, although very interesting. Did you know a lot about Islam before you started?
I've been studying Islam now for years. I wrote nearly 10 years ago, I wrote a biography of the Prophet Muhammad at the time of the Salman Rushdie crisis, because I was concerned about the hatred in the air on both sides at that time. And it seemed to me a great pity that most Western people had no understanding of the Prophet's life at all. There was no readily accessible biography of the Prophet for Western readers. And so I wrote about Islam too in my History of God. And I've been interested in Islam ever since I visited Jerusalem for the first time. And there became fascinated in the interrelationship between the three monotheistic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, and how similar they are, and how profoundly, deeply related, interconnected, and sometimes, of course, there's been great hostility between the three faiths.
Jerusalem really a symbol of both the similarities and also the conflict. What was life like for Arabs at the point that the Islamic religion began?
Well, grim, in a word. Muhammad began his mission in about 610 AD. And he, at that point, his city of Mecca, in the middle of what is now Saudi Arabia, was undergoing a huge economic upheaval. For the first time, the Meccans had managed to establish a market economy, and they were rich beyond their wildest dreams. But the rest of Arabia was in a fearful state. There was just simply not enough food to go round. It's a very, very bleak terrain, as you know. And so the various tribes were endlessly competing with one another for the dwindling and limited resources, and that meant that they were caught up in a series of awful tribal warfares and bloody vendettas that led to counter-vendettas. And similarly in Mecca, because of the new market economy, because of the new wealth, the old tribal traditions were going down the drain, and people were, some people were getting very rich, were going to the war, whereas the old tribal ethos had always insisted that you looked after the vulnerable members of the tribe, and that you didn't have inequalities. And there was a spiritual malaise. The Arabs knew about Judaism and Christianity, which they felt were more advanced religions, and many of the Arabs believed that the high god, Allah, of their pantheon was the same as the god worshipped by the Jews and the Christians. But the Christians, in particular, with whom they came in contact, used to jeer at them and say that God had never bothered to send them a prophet, and that they had no scriptures in their own language. And so they felt left out of the divine plan and stranded, but that changed on the night that Muhammad, who was making a retreat on Mount Hira above the city of Mecca, suddenly felt himself enveloped in a powerful divine presence, and heard and the words of this great Arab scripture began pouring from his lips.
What do we know about Muhammad the man?
We know much more about Muhammad the man than about the founder of any other faith, because he's just that much later. And he was a man. He was not God. He always insisted that he was not in any way divine and had faults just like everybody else. But he was a genius, in a word. One of the greatest geniuses that the world has probably seen. He was a poetic genius. However you choose to look at the inspiration of the Quran, the Quran's is written in the most astonishing poetry. That still fills Muslims with wonder and awe. And it was the beauty of the Quran that convinced many of the first Muslims to convert. But as well as being an absolute spiritual genius, he was also had political gifts of a very high order. And within mere 20 years or so, he had managed to unite the war-torn Arabia under the banner of Islam.
Let's talk about that night, though. He first found himself overpowered by a presence that seemed to actually squeeze him. Mm. Talk about that.
He was woken from sleep and he felt something. He called it an angel later, because these things are impossible to talk about. And he felt he was being squeezed in a terrifying divine embrace. And the angel recite. And he said, I'm not a reciter. I'm not one of these babbling soothsayers of Arabia. And the angel said, recite, recite. And he did. And out came this wonderful surah, all about how God had created human beings from scratch, and that their purpose in life was to listen to the divine word. And Muhammad was terrified. And he crawled on hands and knees, trembling, to his wife, and she cradled him. And she said, no, this is really from God. And she was one of the first people to encourage him. Another thing about Muhammad is he was a man who really loved and needed women. He was a rare man in that respect. He really liked female women's company. And his relationship with his first wife, Khadija, was very, very special. She was his sort of spiritual mentor and director.
Now, Muhammad could not read or write, but he would recite. Yes. And this formed, really, the Quran.
Over the next 23 years, he received these revelations from God. And he would recite them, and people would learn these by heart. And later they were collected in what we now and arranged in what we now have as the Quran. And it was a process. He was listening very carefully to events, because he had no clear plan at the outset, but as events unfolded around him, he would be inspired by God to sort of tie this event into the new faith, and gradually reached some very surprising decisions.
You talked just a moment ago about how beautiful the language is in the Quran. Do you yourself speak Arabic? Have you sensed that?
I'm learning it. But I'm a bit old to learn new languages, and Arabic is very difficult. There was a moment very early in my acquaintanceship with Islam that really struck me. I was in Israel making a television program, and my driver was a Palestinian, and he was driving me home through the West Bank at night, and he picked up some of his friends to give them a lift. And these were all beer-drinking young men, and they never went near the mosque. And suddenly the Quran came on the car radio. Now, if I'd been driving, which is a pretty godless place, with some beer-drinking youths, and the New Testament came on the air, I can see people just lunging for the off button. But these Palestinians, suddenly they were rapt, and they started trying to translate these beautiful words. Words falling over one another in their eagerness to try to convey the beauty of this. And they were saying, oh, Karen, I wish you could understand this. It's so beautiful. And I thought, this is remarkable. This is remarkable that the Quran still has this profound magical effect. It is a sonoral recitation. It's called, the Quran means recitation. So it's meant to be listened to. And the beauty of the words was one, as I say, was one of the first things that convinced the Muslims to listen to the Arabic, to the message of Muhammad, which seemed miraculous.
But translated into English, it loses some of that power.
Well, anything does. Even Shakespeare sounds absurd in French, and the Quran certainly doesn't have the same ring. But it is beautiful. You can, when you hear it chanted as it is, on to a special chant, it really is evocative and powerful.
We've opened our phone lines. You're welcome to join our conversation. You may have an experience with the Islamic religion or a perspective we'd like to hear. Join us at 1-800-433-8850, our toll-free line. Now, Muhammad is not considered a divine figure in this religion. How is he viewed today?
Oh, again, one of the things that struck me very, very forcibly talking to these young Palestinians was how deeply they loved Muhammad. And Muhammad is regarded as the perfect man because his life, they feel, embodied the perfect act of Islam, a word that means surrender to the divine. And so Muslims model their behavior on the Prophet's life, and that so that they try to eat and speak and walk and pray as he did these things, hoping that by imitating his external gestures, they will begin to accommodate the interior surrender to the divine will. He is not a divine figure, and he was very careful, and Muslims are very careful to insist upon this. But because they've identified with the Prophet at such a deep level, he is almost an alter ego. The idea is that each Muslim, by looking at the way Muslim behaves, you can have an idea of what the Prophet was like.
You talked about the grim state of affairs for Arabs at the point that Muhammad first received a revelation. What was the situation by the time he died in 632?
Well, by the time he died, he had, as I say, united the Arab tribes under him, and some of them broke away. And some of them started to challenge his prophethood. But gradually, what had happened was that Islam had worked. Things had changed in the Arabian Peninsula. And people found that the old paganism no longer spoke to their new conditions. And the Arabs are deeply practical people. And they felt that this was the way to go forward. They then began to invade the surrounding territories. Now, it's important. Western people have a wrong idea of this. People often assume that they were impelled by the ferocious power of Islam to pour out into the neighboring countries and convert all the people at sword point. Nothing is further from the truth. The Arabs, for centuries, had been breaking out of the deserts of Arabia into the settled lands, but this time they met a power vacuum. The great empires of Byzantium and Persia had been locked for ages in a very debilitating struggle. They were worn out, and many of the populace were disaffected on both sides, and the Arabs came in, and soon they had created a vast empire, were beginning to had entered history. And this astonishing success and astonishing reversal seemed to endorse the fact that Muhammad had indeed been a prophet of God, and this was the way forward for as God had intended.
With me in the studio is Karen Armstrong, author of Islam, A Short History. She's also the author of A History of God and other books on religious history. We're taking your calls and comments as we discuss the history of the Islamic religion. We hope you'll join us. First, though, we're going to take a very short break, but stay with us.
This Week in This American Life, get over it. Stories of people who cannot get over a relationship that's ended, people who are in that sad human limbo and try to turn themselves into just friends, people who are frankly stuck. Just stuck, unable to forget the past or move toward the future. George Saunders, Scott Carrier, and more this week on This American Life on Public Radio International. That's Sunday night at 6 on WAMU 88.5 FM.
I'm David First. This week on Metro Connection, to charter or not to charter, 3 years in, we'll check on the progress of one of D.C.'s charter schools. Then, open green space, off limits and surrounded by barbed wire, the history and uncertain future of some national parkland in Anacostia. And Reagan on the Mall. Commentator Fred Fisk weighs in on the proposed memorial. That's Metro Connection, Saturday morning at 11 on WAMU 88.5 FM.
Welcome back. We're talking about the history of Islam with a religious scholar, Karen Armstrong, who joins me in the studio. What is the way that most Americans these days hear about Islam is great controversies involving Islamic fundamentalists. What is the state of Islamic fundamentalism today?
Well, it's important to say at the outset that it's not only Islam which has produced fundamentalism. Fundamentalism is a reaction to Western modernity, and it's erupted in every single major faith, including Christianity and Judaism. Islamic fundamentalism is... it's a complex phenomenon. Every movement is distinct. But basically, Muslims, like other fundamentalists, do not want to have their countries secularized on the Western model. And they're fighting to put God back onto center stage. Every fundamentalist movement I've studied, including Islam, is rooted in fear, a profound terror that a liberal secular society is going to wipe out faith. It's true even in Protestant fundamentalism in the United States. And when people are frightened like this, and they feel their backs are to the wall and they're fighting for survival, they often lash out like wounded beasts and become violent. And this has certainly happened in Islam. I think all fundamentalism runs a danger, and Islam fundamentalism certainly incurs this, that in their struggle to survive, they tend to stress the more militant aspects of the faith and let go, overlook those that preach more compassion and tolerance and brotherly love. And this is true all the world over. So you have suicide bombings, you have actions that absolutely defy any decent humanity, let alone any decent religiosity. But Islamic fundamentalism is only just one of the modern manifestations of modern Islam, but it does catch the headlines. And it tends to endorse peoples we've sort of nurtured in the West over the centuries. And this has certainly happened in Islam. I think all fundamentalism runs a danger, and Islamic fundamentalism certainly incurs this, that in their struggle to survive, they tend to stress the more militant aspects of the faith and let go, overlook those that preach more compassion and tolerance and brotherly love. And this is true all the world over. So you have suicide bombings, you have actions that absolutely defy any decent humanity, let alone any decent religiosity. But Islamic fundamentalism is only just one of the modern manifestations of modern Islam, but it does catch the headlines. And it tends to endorse people's the negative view of Islam that we've sort of rather nurtured in the West over the centuries.
For instance, there's an article in the Washington Post this morning about the visit by a UN official to Afghanistan, where she protested the treatment of women there by the Taliban. Yes. The ruling party bars most girls from going to school, most women from working, requires most women to be completely veiled in public. How does this reflect on terms of the history of Islam? Is this a traditional treatment of women?
No. no, let me say at the outset, none of the great world religions has been good for women. They've been male affairs. And the Prophet himself actually had a very good view of women, as I've said, and the emancipation of women was dear to his heart. And in the Quran, women are given a rights of inheritance and divorce that we wouldn't have ourselves until the 19th century. There's nothing in the Quran about veiling all women or secluding them in various parts of the house. That came in after the Prophet's death. But the issue of women, and I quite agree, the Taliban are sort of very retroactive here. The issue of women has become a sore point in every fundamentalist movement, including Christianity, where Protestant fundamentalists in the United States regard feminism as a great evil. Because one of the hallmarks of modernity has been the emancipation of women, the fundamentalist counterculture that is created tends to overstress the traditional role of women, and so they're back in the home and back in veils. And of course, any attempt to coerce anybody in religious matters, that is forbidden in the Quran, but people are doing it, and this is clearly retrograde and wrong.
It does seem to me that there's a difference in the comparison with Protestant fundamentalism, in that in this country there is a constitutional separation of church and state, although religion has no role in public life, but there is a constitutional separation. The very history of Islam is to wed church and state.
Yes, exactly. This separation of church and state, or religion and politics, is part of our modern achievement, and it's actually been very good for religion in this country. But you have to understand two things. First, secularism, which has been liberated for us. I love living in a secular society, but it has been experienced as very aggressive in the Islamic world, because modernization has been so rapid, far more accelerated than it thought. It's often the secularization, it seems brutal. The Shahs of Iran used to have their women, their soldiers, go through the streets of Tehran with their bayonets out, taking off the women's veils and ripping them to pieces in front of them. On one occasion, the Shah gave his soldiers orders to shoot at unarmed demonstrators in one of the holiest shrines of Iran who were peacefully protesting against obligatory Western dress. Some of the worst forms of Sunni fundamentalism developed in the concentration camps into which President Nasser had interred members of the Muslim Brotherhood without trial. Many of them had done nothing more incriminating than handing out leaflets or attending a meeting. Now, in this kind of atmosphere, you can see that secularism seems a bad thing. But it's still true that, in fact, and I've tried to show this in the book, there has been a de facto separation of church and state in the past, in Islam too, because politics is a dirty business, and it's very difficult to sacralize it and to make it live up to the high ideals. Under the Abbasids, for example, the court had a rather secular ethos, and Sharia, the Muslim law, developed as a counterculture to challenge the rich, aristocratic, often sort of unequal ethos of the court. And the Shiites, the minority in Islam, separated religion and politics on a matter of principle. And the Ayatollah who created a Shiite state was flying in the face of centuries of sacred Shiite tradition in that respect. So in fact, there is a tradition for Islamic for a sort of secularism. I've tried to show that in the book. But of course, because secularism has now such a dirty word because of the sort of atrocities that have been performed in its name, people in the Islamic world are wary of it and say, we don't want it.
We have a caller who I believe is from Iran. Lily, hi. She's calling us from San Antonio, Texas. Hi, Lily.
Hi, I'm here. I'm just so up listening to this lady. She's, again, whitewashing, this, which I hear a lot on the radio and on TV, this religion. My country has suffered so much under this regime, and if you want me to tell you, she says so many factual mistakes, I don't know where to start.
Lily, before you do that, tell us about your own experience. You are from Iran.
Yes.
And how long have you been in the United States?
Since the revolution.
And so you came as a result of the revolution?
I came, was it like 7-8 months after the revolution, I saw enough.
And tell us what your perspective is on what the Islamic regime has meant in your home country.
so much destruction. Oh, so much. I was not a fan of the Shah. I tell you that. We didn't have democracy then, but the revolution was for freedom and democracy, and these people took over, and we went so much backwards, you know, to the 7th century. And they say there's nothing wrong with that. You know, we go back to the time of Muhammad, and they glorify as if, you know, that's good to be so retroactive. Regressive form. And she was telling that, you know, people imitate Muhammad's life. Do you want me to tell you about Muhammad's life? Has this lady heard the word taqiyya? Does she know what taqiyya means? It means lying, cheating, stealing anything against non-Muslim. It's okay if it's in the for advancing Islam.
All right, Lily, let's give our guest, Karen Armstrong, a chance to respond to that particular comment.
Obviously, the Iranian Revolution, as I've said, is a fundamentalist movement, and it has gone overboard. And like any movement, any revolution, it was succeeded by a reign of terror, just as the French Revolution was. Under President Khatami, I think there has been a marked sort of liberalisation and improvement there. But of course, religion is very difficult, and not all forms of a given faith live up to the high ideals of the founders. We've certainly had very bad Christian regimes, which have, instead of implementing Jesus's loving ethic, were cruel and exploitative and tyrannical too. So this is again one of the reasons why separation of religion and politics is a very idea. I don't know that's all secure and do anything against Muslims. Like whole of law states against such behaviour. And indeed, the Quran is very positive about the value of other traditions.
Lily, let me give you a chance to make another comment if you'd like.
Yes, I was hearing, you know, Taqiyya, they were talking about it on the radio in Iran when I was there. They were saying that Muhammad married Khadija, a 63-something-year-old woman, when he was 30 years her junior, because of her money. It was to advance his goal. He used her money, and this is imitating Islam. And he also married Aisha, a 9-year-old girl, and they say, and they claim, oh, he was so magnificent in waiting until she was 9-year-old to have sex with her, and a 9-year-old girl is considered mature.
All right, Lily, thanks for your call. Let me give Karen Armstrong a chance to respond.
Well, I think that, I don't think Khadija could have been 63 because she bore him at least 6 children. I think she was certainly older than Muhammad, and it seems to have been a very, very loving relationship. He had many wives later, but it was true to Khadija until her death. And the wives that he had later were largely designed to cement his community together. He was creating something very, very different in Arabia, a community founded not on blood, as a tribal community was, but on ideology. But to give this new super tribe of his cohesion, he often married the daughters of his companions or of the women or daughters of other tribes who came in to the Islamic community. So I think it's wrong to imagine the Prophet, as we often have in the West, as basking decadently in a sort of garden of sensual delights. Many of these women were really sort of rather old, plain, and needed protection. So I think that I know that when you have suffered from a religion yourself, as I have myself from my own religious tradition, that it's hard to see it whole. I've had to work quite hard on myself to sort of look positively at Catholicism, which gave me a bad time when at a certain stage in my life. And now I realise that, you know, that there was more to, much deeper things to Catholicism than just my bad experiences.
Talk for a moment about your own experiences. You were first a nun.
Yes, I was. I started off at 17 as a Roman Catholic nun, and definitely wanted to give my entire life to God. But of course I was far too young to make any such lifelong decision. And 7 years later, with great regret and grief, in fact, I left the religious life and for a time thought that I had finished with God completely, and wanted nothing to do with religion at all. I was quite worn out by the whole business. But then it was actually the study of other religious traditions, especially after my first visit to Jerusalem, when I started to study Judaism, Islam, and Greek and Russian Orthodox Christianity, that brought me back to the idea of faith and made me appreciate what my own tradition had been trying to do at its best.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're going to go back to our calls. I want to thank Lily for giving us a call and sharing her perspective with us. Let's talk now to Bill. He's calling us from New York City. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thank you. A quick question. There was something your guest said earlier that is rather perplexing, and she may not have meant it this way, but as I jotted it down, you made reference to the Prophet Muhammad as being, quote, a very rare man because he liked and respected and needed women. I just would caution you in the future to avoid slandering, you know, a few billion men in history or a few billion Arabs in history. You know, seriously.
I'm
or
sorry.
Non-Arabs. You, think it's, you know, you really should think before. I mean,
I know. I'm sorry.
Kind of silly. But anyway, my question really wasn't that. I had a quick question for you about the issue of mercy and compassion in Islam. I read the Quran when I was young to try to understand the religion, and I got kind of saddened by the frequency of exhortations in that text of the Quran toward killing infidels, killing those who are not Islamic. My question to you is, what are the conflicts within the Quran itself on the issue of mercy versus killing infidels, and how has that been treated by Islamic scholarship through the ages?
First of all, Bill, I must apologize for slandering the male sex. Sometimes I feel, you know, that perhaps unappreciated by them, and perhaps my own sorrows came to the fore there. Mercy and tolerance are very important in Islam. There is nothing in the Quran about infidels, nothing at all. In fact, the Muslims are exhorted to respect the people of the book, people of who belong to a previous revelation. The Prophet never expected Christians or Jews to come into Islam unless they wished to do so, because they'd received authentic revelations of their own. And constantly the Quran insists that Muhammad is not cancelling out the other prophets, people like Moses or Jesus or Abraham. He's coming to bring the religion of the one God to the Arabs, who'd never had such a prophet from God before. And Muslim scholars today, of much greater sort of learning than I, will tell you that if Muhammad had heard about the Hindus or the Buddhists or the Native Americans or the Australian Aborigines, he would have praised their religious leaders too, because all rightly guided religion comes from God. Now, at first, conversion to Islam was not encouraged, because it was thought that Islam was a religion for the Arabs, the sons of Ishmael, just as Judaism was a religion for the sons of Isaac and Jacob, and that Islam was an Arab faith, and it was just one of the another. Their scripture was in their own language. Conversion wasn't positively encouraged in the Islamic Empire until about 100 years after the Prophet's death. We've had in the West this image of Islam being a religion of the sword, but that idea became current in the West at the time of the Crusades, when it was actually the Christians who were assaulting Islam in violent and bloody holy wars. The Quran forbids any aggressive warfare and says it is abominable. What it says is that sometimes it may be necessary to fight in order to preserve decent values. It's a just war of self-defense is the only sort of warfare that the Quran can sort of endorse.
When we come back after a short break, perhaps we should discuss the current attitudes of Islamic states toward other religions and views toward warfare, which perhaps have changed since Muhammad's time. But we'll come back and we'll take your calls and questions, 1-800-433-8850. Join us in our conversation with Karen Armstrong about her new book, Islam. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the members of WAMU and its underwriters, including Tobacco-Free Kids. Additional support for National Public Radio comes from National Public Radio Stations and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, seeking to enrich community life through support of education, the arts, and culture, and the Florence N. John Schumann Foundation for support of independent, non-commercial public affairs reporting. This is NPR National Public Radio.
Karen Armstrong is signing books tonight at 7 at Politics and Prose, 5015 Connecticut Avenue, Northwest.
In Chicago, where they talk about the Bulls and the Bears, a different sport has the town talking.
I used to play sometime, but I never outside in the public. This is neat. I like this.
Table tennis sets have been placed outdoors all over the city. Chicago Ping Pong 2000, today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us tonight for All Things Considered from 6:30 to 8 here on WAMU 88.5 FM.
Hi, I'm Kojo Nandi. Later today at noon on Public Interest, most everyone agrees that the U.S. has been indelibly shaped by the immigrants who have come to her shores. In this special archive edition, my guests discuss the culture, sociology, and experience shared by West Indian immigrants. Then at 1, Sherman Alexie's short stories are gaining popularity and introducing audiences to Native American characters unlike any you've seen before. He joins me for an hour of storytelling. That's Public Interest, noon till 2, on WAMU 88.5 FM.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page, sitting in for Diane Rehm. We're talking about the history of Islam with religious scholar Karen Armstrong, who's written a new book called Islam, A Short History. And we're taking your calls. Let's go to Lansing, Michigan, and talk to Azra. Azra, hi. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much for taking my call. I actually just wanted to let everyone know that there are Muslims in this country that absolutely have had a great experience with the religion. And Ms. Armstrong, I really commend you for your open-minded approach to basically writing about Islam, speaking about Islam. I grew up in this country. I was raised here, and I grew up with such a negative image myself despite being brought up in a Muslim community because I was very heavily influenced by, you know, a lot of negative Western ideals about Islam. I really commend you for setting the record straight in many cases. I also wanted to kind of comment about, I believe the caller's name was Lily. I think she's very representative of Muslims who have had a bad experience based on their political situation or their cultural situation. And that's very typical of, I think, many Muslims across the world, but that's not the religion. And that's what I really hope that, you know, some people at least walk away with, is try to always distinguish between culture and religion. The religion itself has pure ideals. What human beings may do to it, to obstruct it or abuse it, might be very different.
So, Azra, you follow the Islamic religion yourself?
Yes, I do.
And what kind of reaction do you get from friends or coworkers who are not Islamic?
I'm actually a graduate student right now, and I go to I'm definitely a minority at my school here, and I've had a great experience because I started covering my hair. I'm 26 years old, and I started covering when I was about 21. By my own choice. My family, you know, none of the women in my family cover, but it was absolutely my own choice. And I've had a great experience from my non-Muslim friends. The more they ask me, the more I learn about my religion, the more I'm forced to look into it myself. And they've been so open-minded, so supportive, so intrigued, and have so much respect for what they've learned about Islam through me and through other people, because they want to know what's true and they don't want to just go on what the media has taught them or what television or whatever it is. Those are unfortunately the primary sources, and they're not always accurate sources of information.
And also, just tell us very briefly, why did you decide to start covering your hair?
Because I believe that I finally understood the real reason behind it, which was to protect women and their modesty, in the sense that a man should look at me for and respect me. They should not, no man other than my husband should look at me as a sexual object. I should be someone that's respected. They should look at me for my mind, for my intellect, for my spirit.
All right, Azra, thanks very much for your call. Let me turn this over to Karin.
Thank you.
Thank you, Azra. I would agree with you absolutely that not all expressions of a religion can live up to the impossibly high ideal. Religion is very, very difficult. It is a hard thing to put a divine imperative into practice in this tragic, flawed world. That's why Muslims have that ideal jihad, which doesn't mean holy war, as the media tells us sometimes. It means struggle. Effort, that you have to struggle mightily to put the God's word into practice in a very difficult world. And sometimes people fall flat on their face and misinterpret the faith. This happens in every single religious tradition. What we mustn't do, and what is unjust, is to say these extremists are the Islamic norm, whereas our extremists in our faith, say Christianity or Judaism or Buddhism, are oddballs. And because extremism is all or violence is always against the dictates of any of the major faiths.
All right, Azra, thanks very much for calling us. Let's talk to Mustafa, who's calling us from Grand Rapids. Hi.
Good morning, ladies. Well, truthfully, most of the callers have made the points that I did want to bring forward. It's just a thing that I can frankly say that religion, of course, all religions have good points and bad points, and when you look at history, all of religion of the world have gone through their growth throughout the centuries with war or peace. It's very complicated. You can't really put a finger on a good point or a bad point on a religion or any religion in the world. Some people might have had bad experiences, and that is what sticks them, like the young lady from Iran, or the young lady from Lansing who is a supporter of the religion, but I have to bring forward that really that she is practicing Islam while growing up in America, which is really takes away the actual pressure of the society which Islam came from, if she had been growing up in her own society. And I'd like to hear your comments off the air.
All right, Mustafa, thank you very much for calling.
Well, yes, absolutely. I think it would be wrong to say that Islam is exerting pressure on society. A lot of Muslims in the world are demonstrating that they want to become their country to become more religious. In Egypt, for example, Mr. Mubarak runs a secular regime, and he'd much rather Islam was less strong than it is. But the people want religion. This has been one of the Islam is now as popular among the people of Egypt as Nasserism was during the 1950s and 1960s. So there's been a shift in the Middle East towards religion. In Israel too, there's been a religious revival. But of course it's difficult and challenging, having had a struggle and effort to put Quran and its message of equality and justice into practice in an Islamic state, which some of them want, in a global, is a challenge, and it will be a difficult challenge, but not an inseparable one. Christians are having all kinds of debates and difficulties at the moment about the person of Jesus and who Jesus was, and was he divine or was he in fact Jewish, and people, Christians, are arguing about this very, very vehemently. Muslims are engaged in a similar debate about an Islamic state and what it should mean today. That's just as vehement, but it's a way of saying, how do we put our religious faith into practice and implement it in a world that is now so different from anything that the founders could have conceived.
Would you say that there has been any Islamic state in modern times that has worked as both an Islamic state and as a member of a world community?
Well, in modern times, of course, what most Muslims have experienced is the dislocation of colonialism or Western dependence. So modernity came to them, not as it came to us from our dynamic of our own culture, but it came often with political subjugation. So whereas the modern spirit over here was punctuated by declarations of independence on all fronts, not just political, but intellectual, social, religious, economic, in Islam, in the Islamic world, it came with political subjugation. And that's the colonial experience has been very dislocating. And many of these Islamic movements are an attempt to get back to the pre-colonial experience so that people can return to their roots and build a new identity in the modern world. It's a painful and difficult process, and sometimes people fall flat on their face because religion is difficult. We all find if it were easy, the world would be a better place, perhaps.
We thank our callers for being patient when you're on hold for a while. Let's talk to David. He's calling us from Dallas, Texas. David, hi. You're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi. How you doing? Thank you for accepting my call. I basically had the same question as one of your previous callers about the number of passages in the Quran about killing infidels, but I went and got my copy of the Quran as soon as he said that, and it didn't take me long to find a passage to that effect. It took me longer to get on the air. But I did have one marked, and I was wondering if I could read. It's about three lines, if I could read it.
Okay, David, go ahead.
It says, when the sacred months are over, slay the idolaters wherever you find them, arrest them, besiege them, lie in ambush everywhere for them. If they repent and take to prayer, render them alms levy, allow them to go on their way. God is forgiving and merciful.
All right, David, let's give Karen Armstrong a chance to talk about that passage of the Quran.
Yeah, this was composed during the war with Mecca, when Muhammad had sort of left Mecca and was engaged in a sort of really appalling war. Mecca was determined to exterminate the Muslim community, and extermination meant extermination, so the Muslims were in fact fighting for their lives, and Muslims recognized that this is a passage about the Meccan war, not something that is to be applied to all to all walks of life. And you have all kinds of other passages, as I've indicated, that talk about the importance of respecting other traditions other than your own, and insisting in a very emphatic way that there must be, and I also quote, there must be no coercion in matters of religion.
All right, David, did you want to make any other comment?
No, I was just, I took it upon myself to study the Quran, because every time something did come in the news regarding Islam, they would say that that's not what the message of Islam is, that's not what the message of Islam is. I took it upon myself to find out what the message mm-hmm. of Islam was, and I was kind of disturbed at the passages, and they seem very literal. You know, people were saying that's an interpretation, but the passages themselves seemed very literal to me. That was the basis of my comment.
All right, David, thanks very much for your call. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. What would you say is the fundamental message of the Quran?
The basic message of the Quran is that it is wrong to build up a private fortune, and good to share your wealth as equally as possible, and to build a just and decent society where poor and vulnerable people are treated with respect. The Quran is not interested in theology. It doesn't have a strong doctrinal emphasis. Rather, like as in Judaism, is how you behave. That's important, and the Quran and Muslims have to observe five basic practices.
The five pillars
of Islam.
What are those?
Well, first of all, you have to proclaim your faith in the unity of God and the prophethood of Muhammad. Then you have to give a portion of your income every year in alms to the poor. You must fast during Ramadan, and one of the many reasons for this is that every Muslim then will know in his or her gut what it is to be hungry during the day and learn how it is for poor people who can't eat whenever they choose. Then Muslims must pray five times a day Muhammad, this was the first thing Muhammad made the Muslim, his converts do, facing Jerusalem at that time, because he wanted them to worship the God of the Jews and the Christians. And the this was hard for the Bedouin Arabs, who didn't approve of kingship and thought it degrading to grovel on the ground like a slave. But by the purpose of it is to, A, to orient yourself towards God, whatever you happen to be doing at certain moments of the day, and orientation means all kinds of spiritual things too. But then this posture of your body teaches you at a level that's deeper than the rational about the essential act of surrender of your entire being, which is Islam. Finally, if you can, and if your circumstances permit, you must make the Hajj pilgrimage to Mecca. And that is a sort of peak experience, a religious experience of a Muslim's life, of people who have been able to do it. It is very much, it expresses the Islamic experience. Muslims put on a sort of uniform white garment to show, emphasize the unity of the community, and that they're to wipe out discrepancies between rich people and poor people, and the rites do yield mysterious rites, very, very ancient, pre-Islamic, yield a profound religious experience of the divine and of community.
You've written several books on religion, The Battle for God, Jerusalem, The History of God Through the Narrow Gate, a memoir of your years as a nun. You have another book coming out after this book. What is that book about?
It's a short biography of the Buddha. That was enthralling to me. The Buddha is such a star, and I think he has something tremendously important and challenging to tell all religious people. We've heard so much about violence today. We've heard, and we can be violent in all kinds of ways. We can get a kick out of attacking other people, or attacking other religions, and attacking Islam, or Muslims attacking infidels of the West. And the Buddha shows how wrong all this is, that for the Buddha, the way to God, or divineness, or sacredness, or transcendence, is through compassion and love of all living beings. And if we could do that, the world would be a better place.
Karen Armstrong, thank you for joining us today to talk about your book, Islam, A Short History.
Thank you very much.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Elizabeth Terry, Ann Adams, and Nancy Robertson, with Claire Plant. Here's our Karen McManus. And it's been on the phone. The program comes to you from American University in Washington. To order cassette 28512. Schedule information real at WAMU.org. The email address is drshow@wamu.org. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's away at a conference. This is NPR, National Public Radio.